on long called, he was calling Prince Albert. He looked like the fellow on the Prince Albert tobacco can. I can't think of his name at the moment, but anyhow, he got into an argument with Bessie about some telephone call, and he told her what she could do with a telephone. And in those days, there wasn't any court battle or anything. They just came and took out your telephone. She complained to Farr, and he thought it would be appropriate if he'd take his telephone out for a while. So he went up and got the telephone, and he said, Mr. Farr, can I make just one more call before you take that telephone? Yes, go ahead, but make it snappy. He called up the operator. He says, Bessie, get ready, because here comes... get your dress ready, because here comes Farr with the telephone. But probably it originated a long ways away, but they tell that. And I say Eleanor denies it.
Which makes it even funnier. Is she a long-time resident then of...
Eleanor?
Yeah.
She was born here, her mother was born here, her father was born, her grandfather was born here. And her great-grandfather came from Northfield, I think.
And they started the phone company, is that... because the way...
Do you have one of those copies?
I have a book. Yeah,
yeah, they...
because they have a special book.
Yeah.
I mean, all the other telephone books, you know, are the yellow ones, but there's... And yeah. I just wondered what the story was about...
Well, this is an independent telephone company.
I see.
They are independent completely. Privately owned. And it started out as Waitsfield and Faiston Telephone Company, and I think Alty Farr worked for them for a time, and there was McAllister involved in it, and Alty eventually took it over. And then after he died, Eleanor's mother ran it for a while with the help that she could pick up. And then when Eleanor married, they took it over and expanded it. I dare say we probably have one of the most progressive telephone companies in the state, perhaps the country.
Yeah.
We're all private lines, have been for a long time. They had a device when they first started out. We were on five or six on a line, and they used to call it the Galloping Ghost. If you were on more than 3 minutes, you'd get this thing sound like a horse trotting, a galloping. Go on like that for 30 seconds, and then you were cut off. As that was on private. If, of course, you have a toll call, it didn't work on. But if you were doing a private call, either 3 or 5 minutes, and this is cluck, cluck, cluck.
And that was to get you off?
You didn't have to. That was a warning.
That you were going to be cut off.
You were going to be cut off. That went on for 3 or 4 years. It wasn't a terribly popular arrangement.
And they thought that this was a way to keep the phone calls short.
Yeah, well, on a party line. We used to be on a party line. Everybody up this way, out as far as Waitsfield Town line.
Yeah.
Our ring was 13. One long and 3 short. But that was the first of the improvements.
Well, now the phone company went in here, I guess, about 1912 or 1910, 11.
Actually, earlier than that.
Earlier than, maybe, because. I don't know whether I've seen you since I went to see Willis Bragg, but his great-grandmother had a whole...
Previous to that phone company, there was a... Bell had a phone company in Northfield, and he came over the mountain, and there was a Mrs. McLaughlin. I don't know if she was the one at the Four Corners or the one up at the Dowdells. She was the operator. You call her, and she'd plug you in over the mountain. And I think they had a line that went to Granville from here too. And I think that Louise Gold was Robert's mother was the one that plugged the switch in to go to Granville. But I wouldn't say for sure. I think that was the case. That didn't last too long. And there was I probably told you this one before. There was a Mr. Brown lived down here, simple old chap. Some called him foolish. Wasn't as foolish as he had the reputation of being, I guess. In fact, his wife was some related to Everett Farmer's family. Not close, but M, her name was. He's a very pious old fellow. He used to go to all his camp meetings and church meetings, anything to avoid work. And he wasn't a tremendous provider, but they had a big family. And he went off to one of these camp meetings, and the family thought they would, when they get rid of him, they'd bring up a feed for their sister and her family. And they're just sitting down to eat. He came home a little early. Says, T.M., I told you the Lord would provide. But he got a telephone that came through anyway. Hell, I don't know if he had the money, but he got a telephone anyway. And somebody came by selling phonographs about along about that same time, so he bought one of them. Maybe he loved the music. He wanted to share it with everybody. So back in those days, you didn't have to bring anybody. You were on the line just as soon as you took it down. So he got this on the wall telephone. He gets up on his table and he put the horn right up to the transmitter. And he let it run all afternoon. Finally, somebody complained as best they could to Bell over here in Northfield. He called back over to his operator there, and he said, "Can you get somebody to go over and get that damn fool off the line?" And you know, of course, you had a certain ring. Well, he couldn't count well enough to know. About half the time, he'd answer somebody else's. And I heard this statement here. Well, this was more than 50 years ago, probably. Orrin Lovett lived down here. Where the houses, the one across the road from the other, after he turned to go to Warren. His mother was in her 70s or 80s. And the telephone rang several times right off. Within a few minutes, he said, "Well, they aren't going to give Brown time enough to eat his dinner today." He'd go answer the telephone, and every time he'd say, "Hello, Mr. Brown, you want Browns?" She just joked, and he made the statement they weren't. Brown wasn't going to have time to eat his dinner today.
You mentioned church, and what role did the church play in East Warren? Was it a strong center of the town? Was it a Methodist church? What kind of Earl Fuller talks about going down there for some meetings.
But. Well, there was two churches in town. The one up here, I think, was built in 1832. They tell me that the timbers for that church were drawn over the mountain
from Middlebury.
From Middlebury.
Yeah, I read that, I think.
there's another thing, maybe I told you about this. I don't have too much to go on, but the bell in this church up here in East Warren was a Revere bell. Maybe I told you about that.
Yeah, you did, I think.
I had time, never will get it. I'd like to research that a little more. And,
yeah.
Because I think it was a church in Forestdale. It was built about the same time and the bell was sold, and I think it's over there. I hope so.
Yeah, it could well be.
But
now, did your mother used to go down to church every Sunday, or
not every Sunday? We weren't noted for being faithful churchgoers. Probably the attendance is about average. They used to have the Wednesday night Vesper service. She tells about Ida Brown, that was the daughter of old Wilson Brown, proposing to minister in church.
That's right.
I told you about that one, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That was one of the Vesper services in the evening. Don't know what did promote that. Sometimes young folk go to church for one reason or another. Us all, having been a young one, can understand something.
When did the church is gone now, right?
The church is gone now.
What, did it burn or torn down?
It fell down eventually. Torn down and bulldozed in.
When was that?
I went to school up here in 1932 was my last year up here, and it was there then. It was torn down sometime during the time I was away at high school.
And where was it? It was right near where the store is now?
As you turn to go into the store, it was right on the left of the driveway as you go in. In fact, now in Kit Hartson's book, she shows a picture of it.
Yes.
It was very close to where that driveway goes in now. It probably stood not more than 50 feet from where the road is now, the row of trees between there. In fact, somebody had one of the old scales like they used to weigh hay and animals on. And the pit, when I went to school there, the pit was still there where the scale stood, right beside the church, but probably it's on the common. But as I understand, sometime in the early 1800s, 1802, 1803, somewhere, that was given to the main common was given to the people of the town of Warren to be a common, and they were to clear the land and make it usable. In Spalding's reminiscing, he tells about spring training up there. Yeah, that was...
Now, this is John Spalding's son.
I think that's a wonderful piece of work that he did.
It's, I saw it down at the library.
Mm-hmm. And he tells about the spring training, and that's where they went. That was common land. It still belongs to common land. But then just east of that was the church land. The church apparently acquired it. East Warren Methodist Episcopal Society, which comprised of several people, probably 20 or 30. They built the church. They established a cemetery and they had the horse sheds there. Now, I got into quite a discussion about those horse sheds, but I got a picture of them. So, and when I went to school, you could still see the foundation of the horse sheds, but they were gone.
Now, was that store always there, the East Warren store?
No, it was a schoolhouse.
That's what it looked like.
In fact, I got the original permit when I had the trailer park down here to open that store.
Yes, sir.
We had it down here in the at the entrance of the trailer park. Is one of the amenities that went with it.
Who runs it now?
David Butler from he's from over to Middlebury. His father's. He has a father.
His brother, right.
He's got a brother, or his father has a brother lives in Lincoln, I think, or Bristol, somewhere there.
Mm-hmm. I'll be
done. Yeah, I was about to talk to David last night. But he, Dorothy DeFreeze, Marlene and David's daughter, had part interest in it for a time. And it's the big square house just north on the right. You go past the cemetery, there's a little house, Thornson, I think it's in there.
Uh-huh.
It's a dog that'll chase your car there as you go by. Actually, the dog that they have was one of the racing dogs that got too old and retired, and she acquired it. But he always goes out and chases his car to keep exercise, I guess. But then Thelma lives in the old farmhouse just beyond. We're right across from Crystal Art Gallery.
Crystal
Art Gallery.
Oh.
That's an interesting place.
What's the Crystal Art Gallery? I haven't been in there.
Well, they have local artists.
Really?
In fact, the photographer Peter Miller, he had a display in there one time.
Uh-huh.
I went in and looked at it. Thelma. Well, this her mother. I was telling you about this. She's a dead ringer from mother. She's just exactly like her. Her mother said one time that Thelma would never live to call it to harrow what she'd plowed, but golly, I guess she did. One Sonny, this was Thelma's son that lives there now. He's 65, and born 27 anyway. Yeah, I guess he would be just 65. I went down to Grange one night, and maybe I told you about taking Mrs. Somerville down to Grange into a muddy time, and they had a plank that at the front door, and she, as a good grandmother would, stopped down the store and got a candy bar for her grandson. I got out and opened the door for her, and she started to walk up the plank. She slipped off in the mud. She held her pocketbook and her candy bar very, very carefully, so she went right out flat on her face right in the mud. And I helped her up and cut her glasses and said, "Hurt you, Mrs. Somerville?" She said, "No, but it made me damn mad." But she clutched right onto her pocketbook and that candy bar. She saved them, but she stuck her face right in.
Where is Pike Hill? Which is Pike Hill?
It's a big hill just after you turn. Well, you go out across the flat.
Yeah.
As you go to Warren Village, and the big hill that you go down.
To Warren Village.
Toward Warren Village, yeah.
Now, there was, and I was trying to remember, somebody told me to ask you, there was some piece of road, a bend or something, that was called something on the way up Pike Hill. And I don't remember what it was. It was a story.
There was a big bend. There was one we used to call Bobcat Bend farther down.
why was that?
Somebody saw a bobcat there, I guess.
Yeah, no, this was because of some particular story. Maybe a foolish story. I
figured it's a foolish story, I'd remember it.
No, I think it was Marlene DeVries that told me, and told me to ask you.
Oh, wait a minute, no. That was the Windy Willie Corner.
That's exactly right. Now, tell me the story. Now, which is Windy Willie Corner?
That's the three corners down here.
Oh!
We used to call it the guide board. When I was a kid, there was a... Well, that road went right straight through, and there was just a... Well, just a kind of a small flat iron there. You could turn either way. I can't see how they improved it either when they put this big bend in, but I suppose it was. Still have trouble with it. I remember going down to, I had an old 36 Chevy, and we ran it all through the war. Well, the spindle on the right side, right front wheel, apparently the threads got loose or something and cut off my cotter pin. I went to go around the corner. The left front wheel started around the corner, and the right front wheel went straight through. Took a little while to get that back so I could get home. But Windy Bill, he lived at that red house. That was the mailbox there with a flag or something on it. Masters lives there now. But Windy Bill, you should have met him. He had all kinds of stories about the world and theories about them. So they called him Windy Bill. He always talking, and that was the Windy Willie Corner.
Before it was the signpost.
We always called it the guidebook.
The guidepost.
Guideboard. There was a board that said Waitsfield. Mm-hmm. Roxbury said Roxbury. I guess it said Roxbury.
But was it Windy Bill before it was the guidepost? Or
well, I guess they probably, depending who you were talking to. I told you this. It used to be a skimming station up just this side of the Four Corners.
No.
Well, there was a time when, modernization was beginning to take place, and the farmers got together and they built what they called a skimming station. They bought a separator, and probably a churn. And the farmers would take their milk, rather than setting it in pans and skimming it, or owning their own separator, which eventually happened, they would take it up to the skimming station, the big separator, and there was a little building, I don't know if it was here in 62 or not. I'm lost again.
Up above here, or?
No, the Four Corners. No, it didn't. Doesn't show on here that it's gone. Yeah, but there.
Now, by the Four Corners, you mean in East Warren?
By the East Warren Four Corners.
Yeah.
It was probably an eighth of a mile from the fort. It's just this side of the priest's barn.
Uh-huh.
Where the barn is now, on the left-hand side of the road.
Uh-huh.
How they acquired the land, or who owned it. Aaron Estey used to run it. Aaron Estey was the son of the minister that was referred to in the Yellow Painted Hag. This was in the early 1900s. But the farmers all used to take their milk up there, and they'd run it through the separator, and they'd sell them, and they'd weigh the cream, and and pay them for that, and they apparently churned it and sold it. Sort of cooperative creamery, on a smaller scale in Cabot by quite a lot.
More, thank gosh.
more stable too, probably.
How long did that run for?
I don't know. It didn't run for too many years. I would guess maybe 10.
Probably back around 1910?
I would guess somewhere along there.
Interesting.
Well, it came between the time when everybody owned their own separator,
mm-hmm.
and the time when they
had the big milk pans.
When they had the big pans. It's an interim thing. The story probably was one that Marlene was referring to. I told everybody one time. It seems that maybe I must have told you last time I was here about this Aaron Estes. He was kind of a joker. And Bill came in and with his milk, and Aaron wasn't saying anything. And
this is Windy Bill.
Windy Bill, yeah. Will Trask. Trask Brook, we all call it Trask Brook. His father, Horace Trask, I think, was his father. Their origin was in Lynn, Massachusetts, in the shoe business, but they came up here anyway a long time ago. Don't know who the farm did belong to previous to that. On the right side of the road was the old Whitcomb place, and he was one of the proponents of the theory that the world was flat, and he had the map to prove it. There's a society in England, they tell me now, that still adheres to that, but he was a member of that society anyway, and I guess he probably believed it. But anyhow, it seems that Bill took his milk up to the creamery, and he wasn't having much luck striking up a conversation with Aaron that morning. Aaron was kind of setting him up for it. And when Indy Bill said, "Hey, what's the matter, Aaron? Don't you feel good this morning?" He said, "Well, no, I don't really. I had a dream last night that bothered me. It was bothering me all morning." And of course, inquisitive as he would be, he had to know what it was bothering him. So he kept asking me, "I don't know how to tell you." So I don't want to talk about it. Well, Bill insisted on it. So he said, "Well, being you, yes, I'll tell you." Said, "I dreamt last night I died and I went to hell." Oh, terrible place. Terrible, hard. It didn't seem as if I could stay there forever. I finally went to the devil. I said, "Is there any way? Is there anything I can do to change this all?" He says, "Is there any way I can go on to the other place?" I says, "Well, no." "So tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I'll give you three guesses. And if you can, out of those three tries, if you can think of something that I can't do, I'll let you go on." Of course, Windy Bill, he was in this time when they used to go out west in the thrashing, you know, and he always came back with a theory, and this is probably where Aaron got his basis for part of his story. Windy Bill's contention was that the East never could compete with the West. So it's always head to the devil, and you can't flatten out those hills or mountains so they just like they are in the West. No problem. no problem. One sweep of my hand and Vermont will be just as flat as it is out in the west. You know, that was quite a thing. I knew I was in trouble. And I thought a while and I said, you couldn't dry up the oceans, so to be all dry land, no problem. No problem. One sweep of my hand and the oceans would be all dry land. I'm pretty discouraged. I thought a long time on it. And finally I said to my last chance. I said, you can't make another man that looks as smart as Will Trask and put his few brains in his head. And the devil said, pass on.
Bill Trask.
I assume he went home.
Oh, that is. What a wonderful setup. Oh, dear.
I think one of the Vermont books that tells about the going to the creamery, these two old fellows that they always took their milk to the creamery. Sometimes they didn't know each other too well, but they'd meet on the road.